Welcome to another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. My guest on today's podcast is my friend John Gustav Rathall. We'll do two podcasts with John. The second podcast will focus on John's role as Affirmation's Executive Director. Affirmation is an LDS LGBTQ support organization. John has also served as its past prior president. But today's podcast will be introducing you, our listeners, to John. And let me just give you a little background before we go into John telling his story. John is 54. John lives in Minneapolis. John is in a same-sex marriage. His husband, Yaron, and him have been together for 26 years. John grew up in the church, served a mission in the Geneva, Swiss mission, returned back to BYU following his mission. He'll tell the story of coming to terms with his sexual orientation, trying to stay close with God, feeling impressed to leave the church, be excommunicated. He'll share that story. He'll talk about his journey in life, eventually finding his husband, Yaron. Then John will talk about in September of 2005, feeling impressed to return to the church, and we'll talk about reconnecting the church and joining his congregation in Minneapolis, which he's been doing for the last 13 years. Now, John isn't a member of the church, so to speak. But he's a believing member of the church. He's still excommunicated. He's still in this same-sex marriage, and he's been going to church and is navigating both those roads the best way he knows how. So I'm grateful for John willing to share his story, and my hope is that we'll help all of us better understand our LGBTQ friends and understand the unique life journey and how best to support, understand, and minister to them, and also sense their great faith in our Heavenly Father and His Son. And John has great faith in Heavenly Father and His Son and great understanding of our scriptures and great belief in our church. So with that, welcome to the podcast, John.
Thanks for having me, Dick.
So tell us where you grew up and where you served your mission and then coming to terms with your sexual orientation at some point after that.
Sure. Well, when I was a young child, my dad moved to the Rochester, New York area, and he worked for the Eastman Kodak Company his whole life. And I grew up pretty much within a stone's throw of Palmyra, the Hilcomora, the Joseph Smith home. As a young child, one of my cherished memories is attending as a family the Hilcomora pageant, sometimes several times every year. We made a point to bring friends with us to the pageant. We were a very missionary-oriented family. We were very active in the church. My parents, both very devout. My mother was a convert to the LDS church. She grew up in Finland and was raised in the Church of Finland and became a Mormon in the early 1960s. She came to the United States as an exchange nurse, and she reconnected with my dad. My dad was actually the missionary who baptized her. And they reconnected, and he proposed to her, and the rest is history. But they both were very devout, active members of the church. My dad was born and raised in the church and came from pioneer stock. I can count on one hand the number of Sundays that we missed church growing up. We were the kind of home where you accepted every calling, where you paid a full tithe, where we practiced daily family prayer, where we practiced family home evening, and we sought to live the gospel as fully as we possibly could. And I had a testimony of the gospel from the time I was quite a young child, and I received the. As a child preparing for baptism, I actually received the missionary discussions from my dad, who was a stake missionary at the time. And one very powerful memory that I have is sitting down next to my dad on the couch and opening the Book of Mormon together and reading from the Book of Mormon and reading that promise at the end where we're exhorted to read the Book of Mormon and pray about it. And I felt the Spirit as my dad was teaching me about that. And I did, I followed that, those instructions. I read the Book of Mormon. I prayed about it. I got my own testimony as a 7-year-old child. And my testimony has, you know, really kind of only grew from there. When I was 16 years old, I served a mini mission in our ward. Members of the priest quorum were invited to serve mini missions, and I served mine in Binghamton, New York. And after that experience, I just became—I was sort of on fire about missionary work, and I began to go out on weekly splits with the missionaries from that time on, as a way of preparing myself to serve a mission. I worked summer jobs as a painter and as a yard worker, and I saved all of the money that I earned for my mission. And the summer before I went on my mission, I invited one of my best friends from high school to receive the missionary discussions in our home. And so he came and received the missionary discussions in my bedroom, was taught by the missionaries. I was there and participated in the baptismal challenge. And when he accepted to be baptized, at that time I was able to perform that baptism. And I always felt like that was the first baptism of my mission. After that, I went off to the MTC, learned French, served in the Swiss Geneva mission. Again, it was that experience of being a missionary was life-changing. I've written about that, and I've talked about it because, I, you know, as I was serving my mission, one of the things that I struggled with was my same-sex attraction. And from the time I had been a youth, I guess 10 or 11 years old is when I was first aware that I had feelings of attraction to other guys my age. And it worried me and it bothered me. But it wasn't until I was about 14 years old that I kind of put two and two together, and I looked up the word homosexuality in the dictionary, and I realized that that was about me. And from that time on, from the time I was about 14 years old on, I began to really sort of strive to overcome this. And I read The Miracle of Forgiveness by Spencer W. Kimball. I read another book by Stephen R. Covey, The Spiritual Roots of Human Relations. And I really believed that just through discipline and faith and hard work that I could overcome this. And when I arrived in the mission field and was aware that this had not gone away, it was a kind of a moment of desperation for me almost. I remember my very first night in the mission field. After my companion had gone to sleep, I got out of my little cot. I knelt down next to it and I just wept. And I prayed a prayer of desperation and I said, "Lord, I don't know how I can serve you with these feelings." And I had a very powerful spiritual experience at that moment. And the Lord said to me, "I accept your offering and you can serve me." And that reassured me. And it enabled me to just kind of set aside those feelings, to stop worrying about them, and to do my best to serve as a missionary. And in my time in the Swiss Geneva mission, I baptized 5 individuals in 2 different families. two of which subsequently went on to serve missions of their own. One of them served a mission in the Paris mission, and one of them served a mission in the New Caledonia mission. So I came back from that mission and came home, and even though it had been a very successful mission, I still struggled with feelings of despair around my sexuality. This still had not gone away. And I, after coming back from my mission, I knew that I was told, my first BYU bishop put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "John, your number one job is now to marry and start a family." And I just really had no idea how I was going to do that. And so I began to sort of sink into a depression after my mission. And I don't know how far you wanted me to go, but that's my upbringing and the mission that I serve for the church.
I love that story. I love you helping someone join the church before your mission experience. And then, like you know well, and I've talked to so many others, this sexual orientation doesn't change. It's like being blue-eyed or redhead or left-handed.
Yeah.
There seems to be, we don't want to put limits on the power of the atonement to change things, but it seems like that's outside the bounds of the atonement, just like hair color and other things are.
Eventually I came to that understanding. Yeah.
Tell our listeners about
that. But at the time, that was a very difficult struggle for me.
I think one of the things that's interesting for me when I got to know John several years ago was that John holds both of these things concurrently in his belief system, is the beauty of a same-sex marriage and a deep testimony of the church. And how I was kind of surprised when I first met you, John, because I didn't know anybody that did both of those. And obviously you can't fully participate in the church, and we'll get more to that. You come and are
right.
as involved as you can. You're not a member of the church anymore, and we'll talk about that. But you have – it's interesting for me to know that you are someone without membership in the church but with a deep testimony of the church. And it, just like you're talking about the Book of Mormon, your mission. So talk us through your years after your mission when you sort of came to terms with your sexual orientation and consider different paths for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so as I said, after my mission, I went back to BYU. I had gone to BYU for a year before my mission, and then I went back afterwards. I was at BYU on a Kimball scholarship.
Wow.
And
it's a big deal.
It was a big deal for me and my family, certainly, to have the financial aspect of my college education was pretty much completely covered through that scholarship. And obviously it was a real honor to be selected as a Kimball scholar. And, certainly I had a sense of, Dick, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but when I received the letter informing me that I had been selected and that I was one of the 12 young men Kimball scholars, I actually wrote a letter telling them that I didn't think I was worthy.
Wow.
To receive the scholarship, and they ignored my letter and gave me the scholarship anyway. But I did have a sense of I had been given a great gift and that I wanted to make the most of this and I really wanted to use my gifts and my talents to serve the church. Early on, I decided that I wanted to study history, and my life aspiration was to become a church historian. At any rate, at BYU, I sunk into a pretty deep depression in the years after my mission. And by the end of my junior year at BYU, after about 2 years back after my mission, I had become so depressed and so hopeless because of my inability to change my sexual orientation. And I blame myself for that, right? Wow. Because all of my instruction and everything that I'd been taught to believe was that if I was faithful, that the Lord would bless me to be able to overcome this. And so the fact that I had not been able to overcome it, I took it as a sign that there was something fundamentally wrong with me, something lacking in my motivations or my desire, whatever. And so I had become so hopeless by the end of my junior year that at the end of that second semester, I had a plan to commit suicide.
Wow.
When I went home for the summer. And to make a very long story short, fortunately that didn't happen. And part of the reason that it didn't happen is because of a providential encounter that I had with an Episcopal priest named David A. Works. And David became a friend to me, and he also had a remarkable testimony of the Savior, because he had been an alcoholic when he was a young man. And at one point when he had hit bottom and was in a jail cell after getting drunk and getting in a fight, he says that the Savior appeared to him and called him to the ministry. And that testimony of his had a profound impact on me. And also just his loving kindness toward me. He hired me to work for him that summer as a painter and as a gardener. And every day he and his wife were just kind to me and, you know, would feed me lunch. They paid me for the work I did. I was on my hands and knees in the dirt, weeding and planting. And somehow that was healing. And it helped me put aside my desire to kill myself. And later that summer, I went on an internship to Helsinki, Finland. And while I was there, I actually had a spiritual experience in which I felt prompted to leave the church, to resign from the church. That was kind of a shocking thing for me. It was unimaginable to me in some ways, actually. I think I would have just tried to, you know, somehow continue on, somehow try to muddle my way through, and hope that my sexuality would go away or something like that. But there were two experiences actually that I had when I was in Helsinki. One was a moment when, after this long period of depression, and I had, I during that period I had stopped praying, I had stopped studying the scriptures, I had just kind of lost any kind of spiritual practice because I had become so emotionally and spiritually numb because of the depression. And there was this moment when I was in my apartment and I felt the Spirit inviting me to pray. And I felt torn. I was like, I don't know what to say to God. And I don't know how to pray at this point. And I just felt this peaceful, loving invitation from the Spirit saying, please pray. And I got down on my knees and I said, God, if you want me to pray, I'm going to have to be real with you. And I essentially came out to God and I said, I am a homosexual and I don't think there's anything I can do about it. And I received this loving embrace from my Heavenly Father saying, I know this about you because I know you from your inmost being. And I felt nothing but love and acceptance in who I was, and a sense that this was an integral part of who I was, and that this is how the Lord had created me, and that the Lord embraced me in this. And so So that was one spiritual experience that I had. And the other spiritual experience that I had was sometime later where I felt a very clear prompting to ask to have my name removed from the records, which was very confusing to me. I wrestled with that for several days. I kind of argued with the Lord about it. I wasn't quite sure like why God would ask me to do that. Finally I decided to do it, and I began to write a letter, two letters, one to my family to explain to them that I was gay and that I was resigning from the church, and a second letter to my bishop asking to have my name removed from the church records. And as I began to write those letters, I had what I would describe as a remarkable visionary experience. And part of that was a very personal reassurance that I got from the Lord that this was okay, and that my family was going to be okay, and everything was going to be okay. And so I did it. I have this sort of mental image of leaving the safe harbor of the church that I had been raised in and that had taught me everything about God, about myself, about everything that I knew about what it means to be a child of God and a spiritual being. If I was leaving the safe harbor and sailing out onto the open ocean with no idea where I was going to end up. This was 1986. In response to my letter asking to have my name removed from the church records, a church court was convened. I, in the meantime, had transferred from BYU to Northern Michigan University because I was concerned that going back into BYU, I might expose myself to the same environment that had led me to almost commit suicide. And I thought that wasn't healthy or safe for me. So I transferred to Northern Michigan University. And while I was there, I got the letter informing me about the disciplinary council. And that council was held in my absence. My father attended the council and was present. And as I understand it, that was one of the most painful experiences of his life. It was very difficult for my parents and something that they didn't fully understand. And I tried to explain to them that this was something I felt the Lord wanted me to do, and they couldn't understand that. And we went through a really kind of difficult period in my relationship with my parents. But even after resigning from the church, I really wasn't quite completely sure what to make of being gay. And the mindset that I had leaving the church was still that I had two options, that I could either try to marry a woman and try to make that work, or I could be celibate for the rest of my life. And I saw those as really my only two options. And I actually felt a sense of relief having left the church, because there was at that time in the church, so we're talking the mid to late 80s, 1986 was when I resigned from the church. And at that time, we just didn't talk about celibacy, right? I mean, the expectation was you're going to get married. That's the only way you can get exalted is through marriage. And I just felt a huge sense of relief that there was no longer all of this pressure to marry. At that time, celibacy sounded to me like the best thing in the world. Because marriage just was not, you know, I not within my realm of possibility. And I I kind of, you know, I dated some women. I actually dated a former friend of mine from BYU for a while. I dated a young woman that I met through the Lutheran campus ministry, because after I had resigned from the church, I became active in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and was involved in campus ministry at the University of Minnesota. And so I was trying to date, but, you know, not really, that wasn't getting me anywhere. Finally, at one point, I just kind of reached a moment where I was like, okay, I need to choose. I need to decide. Am I gonna get married, or am I gonna be celibate? And I went to the Lord and I began a fast. And I said, Lord, I am not going to eat food again until you have told me what I should do about this. And I was into the third day of my fast. After the first day, I was drinking water, but I was not taking in food. And at the beginning of my third day, I was walking across the bridge between the east and the west bank of the Mississippi River at the University of Minnesota. And I was about halfway across that bridge when the Lord spoke to me very clearly and said, you haven't considered all your options. And later that day, I met a gay man, the first gay man that I had ever met who was openly gay, out of the closet. That evening I went on a retreat that was organized by the Lutheran Campus Ministry, and he was there as part of that retreat. And I got to know him better. And I began to wonder, okay, so the Lord says, I haven't considered all my options. You know, is the Lord saying that I should consider a same-sex relationship? But I took that admonition seriously. And at that point, I decided that I had actually gone as far as I could with dating women, and that had led nowhere. And so I actually kind of checked that off the list and felt I had done my due diligence and explored that option and ruled it out. And so then I wrote a letter to one of my former investigators from my mission who had become a monk, a member of a monastic order known as the Order of St. John. They were sort of a spin-off from the Dominican order. And he was living in a monastery in central France in Grenoble, near Grenoble, near Le Creusot. And I wrote him a letter and I said, I think I would like to come and spend some time at the monastery to explore celibacy. And so he contacted the head of his order and he got back in touch with me and he said, you're welcome to come. There's only one requirement, and that requirement is that while you are here, you follow all the rules of our order. And I said, I would have it no other way. That's exactly what I want. So I flew to France. I spent a summer at the monastery. It was a beautiful experience. I would get up at sunrise and I would begin prayers. There was a chapel where we would gather. We would get down on our knees and we would just be there for hours in silent meditation until the sun came up and the sun was shining through the windows of the sanctuary. And then we would have like a matin service. And then we would go about various activities on the monastery. They had a farm that we would work on. We had scripture study. We were, at the time that I was there, we were studying and doing a very detailed study of the book of Isaiah, being taught by a Dominican brother who was a convert from Judaism and who knew Old Testament Hebrew inside and out. And so he had a Hebrew Old Testament in front of him, and he would read to us from the original Hebrew, and we would discuss Isaiah together. It was an amazing thing. We had meals together in silence. We had, and then we had evening prayers in the evening, like the prayers that we had in the morning. And so I had many, many, and a rule of the order was that we didn't speak to one another unless it was for some specific business, or on Sunday, we were allowed to have conversation with each other at our meal times. I was given the special dispensation to break that rule, and the monks were given special dispensation to answer any questions that I might have about what it meant to them to be committed to this monastic life. And that was important for me in order to be able to learn. And I asked all of the monks that I was able to talk to about, what does celibacy mean to you? And why are you celibate? And one of the things that every single one of them told me is they said, if you are running away from your sexuality, we don't advise celibacy. If you feel a call to this ministry, and if you feel a call to be celibate, if the Lord is telling you you should be celibate, then that's one thing. But if you are trying to be celibate because you're trying to overcome your sexuality, or you're running away from your sexuality, we don't advise it. That was very helpful input from people who knew what celibacy was, and who knew when celibacy is going to work and when it's not going to work. And by the end of that summer in the monastery, I had had many, many hours of prayer and meditation and seeking the Lord's guidance about this. And by the end of my visit there at the monastery, I had a very clear sense that the Lord was not calling me to be celibate. And I returned to Minnesota from that experience open to the possibility of dating men. So for, I guess, maybe for about 3 years, I was in the dating scene, the gay dating scene, which had its own sort of challenges and its own kind of craziness. But one thing that I do remember very distinctly is that when I opened myself up to this and said, okay, I'm going to see what it might be to have a relationship with a man, I felt this just incredible uplift from the spirit. I felt just radiant, actually. I felt like this was absolutely the right thing to do. And eventually, after about 3 years, I met my husband, then my future husband, Euron, and we met at a gay bar. He invited me to dance. I had seen him. I had been going to this gay bar for several months, and for over a period of several weeks, I had noticed him at the bar and kind of thought, you know, he'd kind of caught my eye, and I thought he was very attractive, but I was too shy to go up and introduce myself to him. And he was the one who broke the ice and invited me to dance with him. And I did. And I immediately fell in love with him. And we began to date, and we dated for about 2 months. And then I kind of freaked out and I broke up with him. And so then we were apart for about 9 months. And during that period of 9 months, I had some more time to reflect on him and on what I wanted in life and what I was looking for in life. And at that point, I was even sort of open to the possibility of not really having a relationship. And about 9 months after I broke up with him, I re-encountered him at a meeting of the of representatives of an association of LGBT student organizations. And he was there representing the gay fraternity Delta Lambda Phi. And I was there representing an organization called The Network, which was a group of LGBT grad students. And I saw him in that room, and we sat next to each other, and I just immediately thought, he's the one. And we sat next to each other, and he asked me on a date, and I was delighted to accept. And from that time on, we pretty much became a couple, and I knew that he was the person for me. There was a spiritual sense about it of, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is who I'm supposed to make my life with. And we did. So that was 1992 when we became a couple. And, eventually we, after sort of, living in each other's apartments for a while, we finally we rented an apartment together, and then I guess in 1996 we bought a home together, and it's the home that we're living in together now here in South Minneapolis. We had a commitment ceremony in 1995, which was his idea. You know, he was sort of pestering me and saying, you know, I want to get married. And I was like, we can't get married. It's against the law. We're not allowed to be married. And he's like, well, I still want to have a commitment ceremony. And I'm like, kind of like, why do we need that? We love each other. We're committed to each other. I know I'm committed to you. You know you're committed to me. Why do we need to make a ceremony about it? That was kind of my attitude at that point. And he was like, it's important to me. And so finally I said, okay, to humor him, because I love you, we will do this, even though I don't feel like we need to do this. So we planned a commitment ceremony in August of 1995. We invited all of our friends and family. My parents came, my grandmother came, some of my siblings came. My brother Joe is on his mission in Idaho, so he couldn't come. But we had about 110 of our closest friends and family were there. Euron's family came as well. And we had a beautiful ceremony. My dad actually read some scriptures as part of the ceremony that we had. And that ceremony of commitment changed my life, because here I was making promises to him that I was going to care for him and love him and respect him and honor him. And we were asking God and our family and our community to help us keep this commitment to one another. And it was powerful. It changed my whole understanding of our relationship and what our relationship was about. And it gave me a sense of how important this responsibility is to care for another human being. So that event was a life-changing event for me in 1995. It was a non-legal ceremony. It had no legal standing at all. It was a commitment ceremony that we held. In 1996, a year after that, we bought the house that we live in. And then we just kind of were doing our thing for a while and working and sort of living our lives and growing as individuals and as a couple and learning about what it meant to love each other. And we were involved in a community gospel choir that we sang in, that we loved, and we were involved in a church. We were attending Lyndale United Church of Christ, a UCC congregation that had a lesbian co-pastor and that welcomed LGBT people to be members, and we were active in that congregation. That was kind of our life. And then in 2005, Euron and I were planning a trip to visit my parents, who by this time my dad had retired from his life of employment with Eastman Kodak Company, and my parents had moved to Utah around 2000. And so they were living in Springville, Utah, and we were visiting them for holidays and things like that. My parents loved and embraced my husband, and so we were visiting them regularly, and we were there for a summer visit. And I had been in touch with a former professor of mine from BYU, D. Michael Quinn. I had written him an email and I said, I'm going to be in Utah in August. And do you know, I know you're in Utah a lot. And could we possibly get together and meet? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I'm going to be speaking at this thing called Sunstone. And if you want to come and meet me there, you can. And so I said, okay. Now, I knew what Sunstone was. I had known about Sunstone since I was at BYU. And so I said to my husband, Michael Quinn is going to be at Sunstone and he wants me to go. Should I go or not? And Euron says, well, yeah, if you want to go, go. And so then I would think about it and I was like, oh, there's going to be a bunch of Mormons there. I don't know if I want to do that. And so then I'd say to my husband, I don't think I'm ready for that. I don't think I really want to go to Sunstone. And he's like, okay, don't go. And then a week later I'd be like, I think I got to go to Sunstone. And I was kind of wobbling back and forth like that. And finally my husband was just like, clearly you need to do this. Go to Sunstone. And so I did. I showed up. At the time they were meeting at the Sheraton in downtown Salt Lake. And I showed up there, and the first session that I attended was a session that was being facilitated by Levina Fielding Anderson about the new For the Strength of Youth pamphlet. And so I was sitting in that session, and the content of the session itself was, it was mildly interesting to me, but not really engaging. But I had this profound spiritual experience, and I felt the spirit in a more intense and more powerful way than I had felt in decades. In over a decade, I should say, at that point, it had been over 13 years since I had met my husband and joined with him and had left the church. And this presence of the Spirit, it was so distinct and it was so powerful. And the Lord said to me, it's time for you to come home to the church. That it was so clear. And my immediate reaction to that was anger. I was really mad. And I said, Lord, you cannot do this to me. I thought you told me to leave. I thought you told me to be in this relationship with my husband. How can I come back? How is this even possible? I said, they don't even want me back. And the Lord just said, it's time for you to come back. And I felt such peace. And so I just tucked that away. I told nobody about this experience that I'd had. My husband and I went back home to Minnesota, but it was there and it kept coming back. That was in August of 2005, and it kept coming back, and the Spirit kept saying, you need to go back. And I was like, I don't even know how this works. Like, what are you talking about? And I had this ongoing argument with the Lord for about a month. And finally, after a month of arguing with the Lord, I had this moment, and I can show you the spot where I was sitting when the Spirit said it to me. I was up in the sun porch upstairs in our house, sitting in our hammock, and the Spirit said to me, I'm not asking you to leave your husband. I'm not asking you to do any grand gestures. All I'm asking you to do is go to church. Can you do that? And I finally gave up and I said, yes, if that's all you're asking me to do, I can do it. And I said, okay, I've made up my mind. I'm going back. So this is in September. And at that point, I'm starting to think about this, like, okay, well, so how do I do this? Like, how do I come back? I don't even know how this works. Like, I don't know where the ward is. I don't know what. And so, and then I thought, they're not going to like me. They're not going to want me there. And if I'm going to start going back, I need a support community. And so I had heard about affirmation, like way back in the 1980s, somebody had told me about affirmation. I knew that it existed. And so I looked it up online and I contacted the president of affirmation at that time, who was Olin Thomas. And I told him that I'd had a spiritual experience. I wanted to go back to the church and I needed support. And he said, well, you don't need to go back to the church. And I said, yes, I do. You don't understand. I do. And so then I kind of got the idea that, well, maybe affirmation isn't going to be quite the support community I thought it was going to be. But I connected, and ultimately I did sign up to become a contact for affirmation, partly because I thought if I'm on their website and I'm listed as a contact and there are other gay Mormons here in Minnesota, they'll see that and they'll contact me and maybe, you know, maybe we can support each other. And that did happen, actually, over the years. I was contacted by lots of LGBT Mormons who saw my name in the website and who lived here in Minnesota. And so over time, I got to know quite a few LGBT Mormons, and some wanted to be active in the church and some didn't. And one of them joined the church as a result of an experience she had had with me before I, you know, or shortly after I had started coming back to the church. It was just, there were really fascinating stories that happened. But in October was when I started attending. And I'll tell you one more sort of inspiring experience that I had where I was, so this was like late September. I know I've got to go back to the church. I'm not sure how I'm going to do this. And I'm visiting some friends of mine in St. Paul, Minnesota, across on the other side of the river. And Mormon missionaries come and knocking at the door. First time this has ever happened to me, where I'm at a friend's house and the Mormon missionaries come knocking while I'm there. And my friends look at me and they're like, there's Mormon missionaries on our doorstep. You go talk to them. You're the Mormon. And so I go out on the doorstep and I'm talking to them. And I say, for the first time ever, I'm encountering missionaries since I left the church, and I'm telling them my story and I'm just being open with them. And I said, you know, I've done what you're doing right now. I was a missionary too. And I'm gay and I'm in a relationship with a man. And at that time, Yaron and I had been together for 13 years. And one of the missionaries says to me, what made you lose your testimony? And I said, I didn't lose my testimony. I said, it was because of my testimony that I almost committed suicide. And I kind of told them my story, you know, my gay Mormon story. And they were, you know, there was a senior companion who was kind of wanting to argue with me a little bit. He was the one who said, "What made you lose your testimony?" And there's a junior companion who's kind of quiet through this whole thing and who's just listening and making eye contact and very kind, expression of just great kindness and love on his face. I could feel it. I could feel the love coming from this junior companion, but he wasn't talking a lot. Senior companion was doing all the talking and kind of arguing with me and kind of being obnoxious, right? Like kind of pissing me off a little bit. But after we were talking for about half an hour, and my friends are starting to, like, you know, wonder what's going on here. And finally, they're getting ready to leave, and they say, "Well, you should come to church." And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I just within the last month, I've decided that I really do need to go back to church." And they said, "Well, that's great." And so they gave me a card that had information about how to find out, you know, which ward was the one closest to where I was. And so I took that and I stuck it on my bulletin board at work and I stared at it for a few more weeks. And then finally, I looked up where my ward was. I found it and I got up the courage and I finally went. And I'm telling you, I was scared.
Wow.
I didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. And I walked into the sanctuary. I snuck in at the back just as the meeting was starting. I sat down on the very last row and there were four missionaries sitting in front of me. And one of them turns around and it was that junior companion. And he had just been transferred the Wednesday before I showed up to that ward. And he saw me and this huge smile broke out on his face. He's from Panglitch, Utah. And he reached out and he grabbed me by the hand. And he smiled and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "Yes, I remember you. How could I forget you?" And he said, "I'm so glad you're here." And I thought, there's one person in this ward who knows that I'm gay and who's glad that I'm here. And it kind of went from there.
Wow.
I knew that the Lord was taking care of me. And during that sacrament meeting, I felt the Spirit so strongly. And my testimony came flooding back. And I knew that the church was true. I knew that this was where I needed to be. This was where the Lord wanted me to be. And I felt the Spirit, and I was so glad. Because I knew that if I had ignored those promptings of the Spirit, that I would have lost the Spirit. And I did what God asked me to do. I went back to church, and I have been richly rewarded. And I have received incredible priesthood blessings. I have had incredible spiritual experiences with I've been through, I'm on my fourth bishop now, and I've had incredible spiritual experiences with every single one of my bishops. I have a testimony of the priesthood. I know these men hold the priesthood, and I have seen dramatic. I've seen miracles. I've seen a healing miracle that happened with my sister involving a priesthood blessing. I've been so blessed, and my attendance and my involvement in my ward has just, it's enriched my relationship with my husband. And I know I'm supposed to be with my husband. And I know that this is part of the Lord's plan for me. And I absolutely have a testimony of the church, and I know that I'm going to be a member of the church again someday in good standing. And I'm going to hold a calling in the church. I know this. But it's going to be on the Lord's timetable, not mine. And it's just going to require some patience on my part. But it's going to happen. And I know, people say, like, I've had bishops say to me, like, how do you reconcile, you know, the conflict between what you know about your relationship and what you know about the church? And I say, I don't make any attempt to reconcile it, make sense of it. I just accept that we don't know everything yet. We don't know everything that the Lord has for us to know. All we can do in the meantime is do our best with what the Lord has given us. And I have been richly blessed. And the Lord has given me a lot to work with. And I've shared this on occasion. It's a profound learning for me. I learned from one of my dad's high priest group leaders, and in a lesson that he gave, he said, all of the ordinances that you need, all of the saving ordinances that you need can be performed in a matter of minutes. But becoming Christ-like is the work of a lifetime. And I thought, wow, I can work on emulating my Savior, on being as Christ-like as I can be, so that when that time comes when I can receive all of those ordinances, I'll be the kind of person that I came on this earth to learn how to be. So that's my, you know, that's my testimony of the gospel. I know this is where I'm supposed to be. And I have seen the Lord at work in the church. I've felt the Spirit. And I know it's painful. It's extremely, extremely difficult for people. And some people think that, and when I'm telling my story, some people think that I'm maybe somehow implying that they need to go to the church, or they need to be, you know, do this or be active or do whatever. If anything, my story should be proof that what the Lord wants us to do might be different from what we've sort of been indoctrinated to think we're supposed to do. The Lord's plan for us is very unique and very individual. And it may not be the Lord's will for you to be active in the church right now or ever. I don't know. I don't know what the Lord's will for you is. That's between you and the Lord. And so I'm not telling people they need to do anything but engage in their own deep, profound, personal discernment process. And that discernment process is whatever you have according to the best lights that you have. If you've never had a spiritual experience telling you what to do, then that means it's up to you to figure out on your own what to do. The Lord gave us brains. The Lord gave us hearts. The Lord gave us the ability to discern situations, to figure out what's healthy, what's not healthy, and to act accordingly. And so we owe it to ourselves, and we owe it to our Creator to use what we have to make it work. And if we do, if we're true to ourselves, if we follow our own heart and we're true to ourselves, then it's all going to work out. That is also my testimony. So I'm not trying to hold out this particular path as a path that anybody else should follow. I know it's what I was supposed to follow. It's been an amazing learning experience, and it's not over. And my husband and I are celebrating. We just on Sunday celebrated our 26th anniversary, and half of our relationship now have been active in the church, and we've grown and prospered as a couple, and I've grown as a spiritual being, as a child of God, as a disciple of Jesus Christ.
John, I love this story. It's a powerful story. On a lighter note, I remember, just because it was a great story, on your Facebook page one day, you're out on a ward service project, and you and another member of the ward are delivering food or something from place to place. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know you're married to a man, and he just picks up small talk. He just sort of was small talk with you. Tell us just about that story. I just thought that was a fun story.
Well, you know, I've had a couple of those kinds of experiences, and I've never had a really bad experience with a member of the church around this, and when I have had those experiences where I've been, you know, on a service project or talking to a member of my ward, or, you know, I've had those situations where I've come out to individuals, I've never sensed anything but respect and love, and I think there's an advantage in being excommunicated in that I don't pose a problem. My church leaders aren't sitting there scratching their heads thinking, what are we going to do about John? I'm the fact that I am excommunicated means that, you know, as far as, you know, church discipline or whatever, there's no action that needs to be taken. And it's the same with members of my ward. You know, the fact that I'm excommunicated, but that I have a genuine love for the gospel. And my reason for being there is because I want to grow in the same way that they want to grow. I'm not there to make a point. I'm not there to, like, convince them of this or that. I want to feel the Spirit like they do. I want to learn. And so it takes all the pressure off those relationships.
Your ward lets you serve. It sounds like your ward has created space for you to serve in, I don't know how to define them, non-spiritual. You're obviously not teaching Sunday school.
Right.
You're attending all three meetings, but you are doing things like serving in temporal service assignments, and that seems fine for everybody, and you're able to give value. And that's – it senses your ward is creating space for you to serve and to help build a kingdom.
Yes. Like anything that I can do without a formal calling, I've been invited to do. I've sung in the choir. I've participated in building cleanup. I've gone on service projects. My favorite place is the Bishop's Storehouse. I love stocking there. I love going on those drives across Minnesota where we deliver food to drop-off points.
And you've gone out with the missionaries as they've been teaching. I think you've told me you've split with the missionaries.
Yes. I've occasionally partnered with the missionaries with the permission of the appropriate authorities, often in situations where they have an investigator who's concerned about LGBT issues, or sometimes I've had linguistic skills that I could contribute because of my French. For example, I had the great privilege of being able to be involved in a baptismal interview with a sister from Africa who did not speak English and needed me as a French translator. It was a beautiful experience for me to be able to translate those baptism questions into French and then translate her answers back into English.
That is a
in preparation for her baptism.
We could just stop, and all of our listeners just process that for a while, and the beauty in that. That's really a beautiful, unique situation, John. A couple thoughts on this podcast. I think we should talk as a separate podcast about affirmation. I'm going to invite John back, and we'll do a separate podcast because I want all of our listeners, after you've heard John's wonderful, unique life story, to then let's talk about affirmation and what affirmation does and John's role with an affirmation and his advice to parents of LGBTQ children as well as other LGBTQ. So let's do a separate podcast if John will come back, and that would be a great podcast for a whole separate podcast. But John, let's go back to part of your journey. One of the things that I think is hard for members of the church to kind of get their arms around is you getting personal revelation that's different than the general teachings of our church. Obviously, we teach you, none of us can get personal revelation for the overall direction of the church. I'm reading the church history right now of examples of early leaders that when Joseph Smith was alive, felt they had revelation for the whole church. And we learned in those early years of the church that Joseph Smith and subsequent prophets had revelation for the whole church. But this is a different situation because you're getting personal revelation that I would call it's outside the doctrine of our church and the teachings of our church that I invite everybody to follow. And so I would think some members can't quite, you know, that would be difficult for them to process and believe maybe that the revelation you got is actually from God because it's not consistent with the general revelation from the church. Some might say, well, you got revelation from other sources. And I'm sure you've had to answer this question over the years and people have challenged you. So what would you say to our listeners about that?
Well, first of all, I understand it. And I certainly struggled with that myself. Like I had to go through my own process of, and you know, my immediate reaction to some of these revelations was disbelief. Like, did I hear this wrong? Like, is this actually what the Lord said to me? And often I would, you know, I would ask several times, and sometimes only reluctantly accept that this is clearly what the Lord said to me. Ultimately, the insight that I had, you know, came from this idea that by their fruit shall you know them. And I thought, okay, so if a revelation that I receive is from some source other than the Lord, then we're probably not going to get good fruit from it. But if the fruit that we're getting is good, then that's probably a sign that it actually is from the Lord. And in some ways, you know, I love that, you know, the parable of the seed and in Alma, it's what, chapter 32, I think, is the chapter with that parable of the seed.
I think you know the scriptures better than I do, John, after talking with you several times, but go ahead. I think you're right.
But that idea that you plant a seed and the moment you plant it, you can feel like whether it's a good or bad seed. You kind of get that, right? It says, you know, it swelleth and it beginneth to grow, right? So like as soon as you plant that seed, you usually have some kind of a sense of whether it's good or not. But there's also a process of like days and weeks and years where that seed eventually grows into a tree and you get to see what kind of tree that is and then what kind of fruit that tree produces, right? So what I realized is that there's a process of you have to be patient and you have to wait and see what kind of fruit is born by this. And so part of one of the powerful insights for me as well is that, look, if you're doing the best that you can and you alone know, right? Like if you're engaged in any kind of self-deception, at some level, you know, but if you're doing the best that you can and you're being as honest as you can, and you really feel this is what the Lord is asking me to do, I think there's a grace in the atonement in that like if I, with good intentions and with sincerity, make a mistake and I do the wrong thing, and then I learn through, I learn the hard way, right? I make the mistake, and then that choice, that decision brings bad fruit into my life. Like, that's the grace of the atonement, is that I don't have to keep watering that tree. I can pull it up and uproot it or cut it down or do whatever I need to do with it, burn it, whatever. Right? That's the atonement. So I knew that there's a grace and a love in God's interactions with us that would enable us to course correct. And I have had to do this countless times. Countless times. And there's never been a point in my life where I could say, I'm done. I'm not making any mistakes anymore. I don't need the atonement anymore. There's never been a point in my life where that's happened. But I know that so that gives me a level of trust. Of if I feel that this is what the Lord is telling me to do, I can go with that and see where it leads me. And then if down the road I'm like, oh, that must not have come from the Lord. Then you course correct. But I think ultimately, I look at this as the work of a lifetime. Like we don't know God's ultimate plan for us probably until the hereafter. And I think maybe if we're lucky, by the end of our lives, we'll begin to get a pretty good sense. And I've seen this like in the lives of people who've gone before me, like my blessed mother or my grandmother. Like these were women who became sanctified women and who lived lives of love and service and piety and who died without an enemy in the world, because they were so Christ-like and so loving. And I think they showed the way. Like, I got to see what a sanctified life looks like. So I look at my own life and I constantly ask that question, like, is this choice making me more Christ-like? Is it helping me to live more like? And what I found with my relationship with my husband is yes, yes, and yes. Like, that relationship with my husband has been a crucible. It's been a refiner's fire. It's been a context in which I've learned about sacrifice. I've learned about listening, patience, kindness. I've had to overcome my ego in order to be the kind of husband that he needs to be, in order to keep those promises that I made to him, to care for him and love him and help him, right? Like, if you truly love another human being, your primary responsibility in life is to help that person be the best them they can possibly be, right? And so these are all things that I've learned in my marriage. So my marriage with my husband has just borne so much good fruit in my life. So much rich, good fruit. And we became foster parents in 2008, 3 years after I had started attending the church again. And we felt this as a calling. And we had a chance to raise a gay son and to be a positive influence in his life. He chose us and the foster care agency chose us because he was gay and they wanted parents who could be good role models to him. And so we had this beautiful experience and we foster parented two other foster kids for much shorter periods of time. Glenn, we had for years until he transitioned to independence. And he's grown up to be a beautiful, wise, kind young man, and his husband Will, and he works for the city of Minneapolis now, and we're so proud of them, and we've seen so much good fruit in their lives as a result of their love for one another and their commitment, and they're following that example that Yaron and I tried to set for them. So that's all I can say. And
That's a really good answer.
I hope this isn't disturbing to people.
No, it's...
I just let the chips fall where they may. And ultimately, my response to people would be to say, give it time and the truth will out. Like, if something is false and if something is wrong and if something is evil, it will show itself eventually.
It's a great answer, John. And I think, you know, as we first visited a couple of years ago and I stepped into this space, I've learned to hold ambiguity. I've learned to hold two thoughts in my head that sometimes if I put them together, they're harder to reconcile. And that to me is, for me, I think a sign of increased spiritual maturity. And as I'm trying to come closer to Christ and better understand my fellow men, we're coming to the end of this podcast. So, in my experience, I just honor your life, John. It is, some of your life is outside what I would call the circle of the doctrine of the church that I believe in, support, invite everybody to follow. But I recognize through the principle of self-determination and personal revelation that people may have paths that are outside of the church that I believe in. And your path is unique because you're kind of back in the church. I guess I look at, 99% of God's children being outside of our restored church. And so I'm at peace that you chose a path that is right for you. I don't have any reason to sort of doubt your path or try to figure out a backstory behind it or what's really going on here. I've been in meetings with you. I've interacted with you. I felt an incredible spirit. We'll talk in another podcast about what we're doing with affirmation. I know you have a good relationship with many people in a more senior leadership position in our church, that you're a bridge builder and creating a great deal of healing and understanding because you have a unique life mission. So with that, John, thank you for joining us. Any last thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I thank you very much, Dick, for having me, and I appreciate everything that you do for LGBT Mormons and their families, and thank you very much for doing what you do.
Well, thank you, John. You're a great man, a great friend, and have helped me be a better person, a better Christian. You've given me spiritual insights, doctrinal insights, and I love the story of your ward, and you've told me many times of the people in your ward and that, love you. And to me, that is the gospel of Jesus Christ, is loving everybody. So thank you, John, and thank you all for joining us on another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love.